Hello, listeners, and welcome to yet another edition of In Conversation with Ashwin. For those of you who know me would know well enough that I'm more inspired by people I know personally than the Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, or Elon Musks of the world. And there's something about the personal connect that allows inspiration to flow effortlessly. And today's guest is one of those people in my life who's been extremely inspiring and always pushed me to get the best out of myself. So yes, our guest for today is Rohan Rajiv, and the theme of our conversation is inspiration. I had a great time recording this with him in person. Our discussion dives into philosophies that give us a sneak peek into Rohan's perception of life and also the stuff that matters to him. We speak about his favorite book, his writing habits, his early childhood, and even Bitcoin. To tell you a little about Rohan, he currently works at LinkedIn as a product manager. And prior to this, he graduated with an MBA from Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, worked as a consultant helping clients implement strategy across 14 countries at Aconnect, which is a boutique consulting firm, and earned an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from the National University of Singapore on a merit scholarship, which we discuss on the podcast as well. His personal mission statement is to build active relationships with family, which he calls close friends and family. I'm going to steal that from you, Rohan. Along with that, his personal mission statement is to learn and strive to have a positive impact on his world and in time the world. He has blogged A Learning A Day since May 2008 on his blog www.alearningaday.com. You can find him on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc., the handles of which I've mentioned in the description box. Rohan to me is super inspiring, and personally I share a great relationship with him, from book recommendations to writing inspiration to just helping me think through a few life decisions in different periods of my life. Rohan's always been there, whether it's over an email or call. He's always been super responsive and super helpful. I cannot thank him enough for the influence that he has had on my life. So without further ado, presenting to you my wide-ranging conversation with Rohan Rajiv. Welcome to the show, Rohan. How's it going?
It's good. Excited to, I guess, both hear from you and be in conversation.
Right. Diving right into it. So tell us a little about your early childhood and how that has ended up having an influence on the career choices and the life choices that you've made.
So my sense with these things, right, is that we tend to have things that happen to us, and then there are the stories that we tell ourselves about the things that happen to us. And I think what's interesting right now is I don't know how much of what I will say is what actually happened was the story I've told myself, right? And
yeah.
And these narratives are important because I think this is how we process things. So my narrative for my childhood in general is that there are three things that matter to me. It's people, learning, and impact. And each of these came to be because of events in my childhood. And specifically, I lost my dad and my uncle when I was very young. And this was between ages 9 and 12. And both were, you know, one was an accident, one was suicide. These were difficult times for me, for the family. I'm not sure I comprehended how difficult they were at that time, right? But the follow-on years were definitely fairly hard. And I think what came out of it a few years later, actually many years later, was probably a couple of lessons learned. And I think the first lesson was around people. And it was this idea that people are all we have at the end of the day. And that was a very powerful realization. The second one was this awareness, and not yet acceptance, but awareness of this idea that life might be shorter than you think. Right? And I think both of these fundamentally changed how I thought about things. There's a really great quote by a former UN Secretary General. His name was Dag Hammarskjöld. And he said, in the final analysis, it's our approach to death that influences our conception of life. And I think this idea that this might not work or so that this life might be shorter than you think, was led to this idea that, you know, maybe I really want to make the most of it and have impact, right? So I think People and Impact came out of that, and I felt as I really wanted to do well, and my mom was very insistent that I should get out of the country, so going abroad was a dream. And at that point, we weren't able to afford much, so getting a scholarship to go abroad was very important. And there was this one school in Singapore, the National University of Singapore, that gave a scholarship based on some academic merit. And so going there was important. And I ended up spending, once I did go there, and I was fortunate to get in, I spent most of my time on a startup, which again made sense because it was a sort of thirst to do something, to have impact, right? And I didn't know what a startup was, but I had met somebody who I really liked, and this was, again, the person connection. And I just, that person seemed to be doing interesting things, so I followed him. And did this for a couple of years, but it was along that way that I realized that actually this constant search for impact is a very unhappy way to go about life. Because you're never satisfied, right? Never enough impact.
Yeah.
And as tiny as my impact was at that time, it was never enough. And there were a couple of incidents that just brought this unhappiness to light. And I think after one of them, somewhere down the line, I think I was in a low and thought, man, I really thought of myself as somebody who was very confident, but I was not behaving as one. And I thought maybe I should start writing my failures down in a blog and then sharing them every day, because I also didn't have the discipline to do anything every day. And so then my blog came to be, and I think over the years, the philosophy of the blog was always learning a day, never failure, only learning, right? And and so I think over the years, learning kind of inserted itself before impact. And so that in some ways is again the narrative that I think I have gleaned out of all of those years.
That's extremely inspiring, because when you speak about narratives, I don't know if you've read The Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb, and he speaks about narrative fallacy there. He says nothing is scripted. Like,
absolutely,
we make it sound like it's scripted, but there's a lot of randomness involved.
Exactly. And that's definitely the case. But as I said, there's what actually happens, and then there's the story that you tell yourself. This is the story that I tell myself.
That is so true. That is extremely humbling to hear. Right, and I know you to be a voracious reader. Let's say you had to gift a book to somebody. What would that one book be that you would gift to different people?
Yeah, I think without a question, it would be The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey.
Yeah. What did you like about the book, and why do you think that's
So I think it's two ways. So nowadays, I think if I was gifting this to a teenager, I might still ask the teenager to read Harry Potter. And I think there's a duality involved here, and maybe it comes with age, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But I've realized off late, living in the US now, and just looking at the state of the world, I feel some of the concepts that J.K. Rowling wrote about, whether it was like mudbloods and half-bloods and the conflicts inherent in sort of branding other people as them and us wanting to be better than them and all of that, I feel that's incredibly powerful. There are some very, very powerful life lessons there. So and I think especially when you're younger, it's so important to stoke creativity. So I would say maybe I would recommend that. It's a maybe. But in terms of the book that I consider the wisest book I've ever read, it's by far The 7 Habits. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. I sometimes think of books in terms of, you know, what is a metric I think of is like wisdom per page. And wisdom per page in terms of seminal insights on how can you be just a better human being, I have yet to come across a book that is so based on powerful principles. It's still to this day, I think it's taken me many, many years to attempt to live the first three chapters of the book, and the logic behind the book, right, is fantastic. So again, when I think about like what is a good book, what is a great book, so a good book to me is one where you can think back to it 3 years from now and remember 1 to 3 things from it. And if you remember one thing, it's already a good book. I actually think 3 is already getting to greatness. And I think what great books do is they add structure to that, in that they make their overall framework somewhat digestible. And the whole of Kavi's book is focused on essentially these two journey points, two points in your growth. He says we all begin as dependent people, right? We don't take responsibility for ourselves. We are kids, right? And this is and essentially what he says is that the first three habits as a result is getting from what he terms dependence to independence, right? So he says, yeah. This is how you master yourself. You first figure out that you are responsible and you can take responsibility.
Yeah.
You learn to begin things with the end in mind. And then third, I mean, once you have sort of the vision for where you want to go, third, you prioritize and get things done. And then you move from there to learning to work with people, which is where he talks about the abundance mentality and seeking to understand framing, right? Because this is age is not a part of this discussion because there's no correlation between age and wisdom and age and maturity, right? But this book's framework is one in itself so powerful, and I think there's just a lot of truth in the book. I think following it does what it says it would do, and it does make you more effective. It does make you better. Yeah. And you just realize it's a lifetime of trying to be a better version of yourself.
True. That's extremely helpful. You've been working in LinkedIn for about a couple of years now, and you have a kid recently. You have so much else to figure out. What is that one or two things that you do that help you keep sane? Whether it's meditation, exercise, anything that just helps you deal with the overwhelming pressure that's thrown at you.
Yeah, I don't know if I feel so. I don't know if I feel all that much pressure. I think it's partly there's a lot of things, right? So it's a lot of little things that help, and it's a lot of little things that you pick up over the years and that have compounded over the years, right? I would say if I had to look at big drivers, I have found that sleeping 8 hours or close to 8 hours is probably the most important driver of my energy and happiness. Once you get sleeping off the table, the second is eating as healthy, wholesome food as possible, right? Given constraints and all of that. I think the drivers after that are, I guess eating ties in with consumption, right? It's like, what do you consume in terms of the food, in terms of ideas, in terms of, so all of that stuff definitely adds up and plays a big role. And tied in with consumption in some ways, a huge driver for me is writing, right? So writing is the habit of writing is very meditative for me because it's something I do first thing in the morning. It's something that helps me synthesize.
First thing? It's the first thing.
Mostly. Very close, right? Okay. So sometimes it takes a few minutes before I kick into gear, but mostly it's definitely done in the first hour of the day when I'm awake, right? And so that helps me synthesize, put things in perspective, reflect, become a little bit more self-aware. So I think it takes everything that I've consumed in some ways, especially the non-food, ideas and all of that, and helps me make sense of the world.
Yeah.
So I would say that would be a huge driver too.
That's interesting.
And again, as I said, after that there's a hierarchy, and there's exercise, and then there's, and maybe it's not even exercise, it's activity.
Yeah.
It's like staying reasonably active.
Yeah.
Is, I think, a huge driver too.
Good to know. This is an interesting question. In fact, it's one of the questions Tim Ferriss asks on his podcast. In fact, a couple of other questions are borrowed from his. He asks this question to every guest of his, so I'm going to ask you that. If you could put anything on a massive billboard for the world to see, what would it be? For example, Jim Rohn says that you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. I think Usain Bolt or another famous athlete says that the world doesn't owe you anything. What would that one thing be that you would put on a billboard for people to see?
Yeah, this is a really difficult one. I love Jim Rohn saying. It's one I use a lot because I think it is incredibly powerful. I think mine would be something to the tune of every moment we can choose to either judgment and stagnation or learning and growth. And I think it just matters because one of the most dangerous beliefs that is out there and that a lot of adults especially believe in is that you cannot change and grow. And by now, you know, there's enough empirical evidence that that is wrong. And two, it is very damaging. Right? So I'd say something along those lines. Yeah. Or maybe it would be you can change.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's good. Judgment and stagnation versus learning and growth. Right. That is definitely something to ponder upon. Last question. I wanted to discuss your favorite book of the year, which also happens to be mine, Trevor Noah's Born a Crime. What did you like about the book?
There's a bunch of things. I'll try to keep it to three. The first one was a better, or almost a connection to what it might have been. Or maybe it's not even a connection. Maybe it's just increased empathy for what it might have been to live in extreme poverty. Because I've not had any experience that is close. And I think Trevor Noah managed to convey that and have me experience it in a way I hadn't. And I think one of the beautiful things, there were a few things that sort of came out of that. The first was, there's this, again, toxic belief that poor folks are poor because they don't try hard enough. And you realize how far away that is. You realize how much privilege is baked into our lives and what we do and what we achieve. And I think that was probably the sort of one big takeaway, right? Is that, man, there's a lot of hidden privilege I take for granted every single day. And he just brought it out so beautifully. I think the second thing was, there are a lot of touching moments in that book. And I think one of them that is particularly powerful to me was he describes how his mom tried really hard to make sure he was exposed to a world outside the ghetto.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but there's a line where, you know, obviously they talk about going to rich people's homes, seeing rich folks' homes, yeah, seeing prettier, better neighborhoods. And I think somebody in the ghetto used to tell his mom, it's like, why do you take him to all these places? He's not going to know anything beyond the ghetto anyway. And his mom said something very poignant, and she said, he may never get out of the ghetto, but he should know that there is a world outside of it. And you realize how important it is to be exposed to possibilities, right? Because we are what we do. What we do is an extension of what we think. And in some ways, what we think is completely an extension of what we are exposed to. And so it's so important to sort of feed that source. And that was an incredibly powerful thing. Because I think sometimes we all get lost in, you know, all the constraints that we have. And you realize there are a lot of simple things we can do at any given point to expand possibilities. So I'd say that was the second one. And then the final one was, I mean, one of the great things. So I love stand-up comedy. And I think great stand-up comedians are fantastic at making observations. And so George Carlin was some of his rants about stuff and so many other sort of micro topics are just fantastic because they in making fun of what it is to be human, they also observe all the quirks of decision making, etc. I think that's sort of the beauty of the book and the beauty of stand-up comedy in general is that Trevor Noah has a very rich life, a lot of rich, powerful, often tough experiences, and yet he tells the story in a very natural,
humorous way,
yeah, and gets you to realize just so many powerful things if you're open to it. And I think to me personally, I'm one of those for whom humor has never come has never been a default setting. Mm-hmm. But I think as I grow over the years, I'm appreciating just how powerful it is to keep a sense of humor, not react to every situation, right, but to respond to it with a bit of humor. So I think that book was very inspiring.
Yeah, it was. I think I read another book, Man's Search for Meaning, by Viktor Frankl, and he talks about briefly about humor and suffering. And that just for a moment makes everything seem not trivial, but like dealable.
Yes.
Like you can deal with it.
Yes.
It's not too bad.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think Trevor conveys most of the gory stories.
Yeah.
Most of the treacherous stories and ends with a dash of humor. That's just okay, this guy is incredible.
It's very well. One last thing is I love people with perspective because I think it's very important to know your place in sort of the really grand scheme of things because it puts things, you know, the highs need not be all that high and the lows need not be all that low. And I think despite the fact that he's gone from really nothing to being the star that he is, I feel one of the things that the book almost reeks off is perspective. And that's incredibly inspiring.
And coming back to your point on age not being directly proportional to wisdom, like, case in point, Trevor Noah is probably early 30s and he's just got so much to tell, probably because of the experiences, but again, age is never
a no, and it's not just the experiences. I think a lot of people go through experiences. I think wisdom and perspective comes from synthesizing those and thinking about those and writing about those and you know, developing models that help you make sense of it. So credit to him. I mean, it's incredible.
That's interesting. Right. To end the show on an absolutely random, yet pertinent to what's happening in the world, what's your take on cryptocurrency and blockchain?
Whew, this could be
it. I mean, maybe keep it short. And what do you think on the surface of it?
Yeah.
And maybe a couple of points to back it up.
This is a really, really, I mean, this very nuanced topic, right? And it's a topic very few understand. And one of the things I'm learning is that the more I understand it, the more I understand the power of this. So there's a few things, few sort of fundamental principles, right? Maybe I'll just talk through three of them, and then let's see where we end up. So the first thing is the blockchain technology is a very simple idea. It's the idea that you can have a database that is shared by all recipients, but is owned by nobody. Right? So this concept that you can have a centralized database with decentralized ownership was something that was not technically possible. Right? So you needed middle people. You needed PayPal to say, you know, Ashwin owes ABC $3, ABC owes so and so. Like, all of this stuff was maintained by an organization because that's how the technology was built. The blockchain makes it possible for everybody to own this ledger, to everybody to have a copy of this sort of this database without anybody owning it.
Yeah.
That's the fundamental innovation underpinning the blockchain. It is, from a technical standpoint, it is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
The sort of amount of potential that this can lead to, right? It's incredible. And I think the way to think about that and the way to make sense of that is that the internet and technology, information technologies in general, have moved towards democratizing any big institution's hold on information. Right? And this is very important because information is the information, the structure of the information industries is what drives freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Because at the end of the day, it's kind of to my point, it's like we are what we consume. Because what we consume influences what we think influences what we do. Now, 100 years ago, individuals did not have control over this stuff, right? Governments controlled this stuff. You had one channel, if you had a television at all, 40 years ago in India. And Indians would see Doordarshan and whatever was on Doordarshan was controlled by the government, right?
Yeah.
Now, the government has absolutely no control over what you read on Facebook, what you know, go and post on LinkedIn or what you consume via YouTube. And the internet did that, and the internet went a step further in democratizing it. But over time, we've still had internet middlemen. And what the blockchain enables, you know, in some ways in a future world, is permissionless innovation, right? So that's kind of principle number one. Principle number two is cryptocurrencies are an interesting piece because I think number two is cryptocurrencies are an interesting piece because cryptocurrencies, and people think of Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is an example of what is a pure play currency in some ways, built on the blockchain.
Yeah.
Now most cryptocurrencies have what is called the token model.
Yeah.
And what they are effectively are incentive systems. They are incentive systems that are very different from the incentive systems we have today. Today, if you build a company, if Facebook or LinkedIn or take any big social network, right? All of the value that Facebook gains goes to the people who own equity on Facebook. right? You and I could be bringing great content to Facebook, but we don't get compensated for it.
Yeah.
The token model promises to change that. The token model incentivizes people. Anybody who brings value to a platform with a token model,
you get merit.
Gets merit. And if that token becomes particularly valuable, then everybody gets value. So it's a very different way. It's again going back to this idea of permissionless, middlemanless innovation, right? And that's a very powerful paradigm. It's a paradigm that's very different from how the world operates. It's inherently incredibly disruptive, and we are kind of seeing the beginnings of it. And kind of this is kind of getting to principle number three, right? Is that, you know, every technology goes through hype cycles, and I think where we are with crypto, depending on who you ask, is like somewhere between 1970s internet and some 1990s internet, right? So we're seeing the beginnings of this experimentation. It is unclear if Bitcoin will be the $1 trillion market cap cryptocurrency. It might, and it looks like it has a really strong chance of being so. But I think to me it's fairly clear that it will be hard to imagine an internet without the blockchain in 40 years. There will be a $1 trillion cryptocurrency. The only question is which
one.
So so I think it's a... I think the more you understand, at least somebody said, the folks who disagree on the potential of the blockchain are people who don't understand it. And I think, at least in my very limited experience, in my very limited understanding, I think that is actually fairly accurate.
Yeah, that's actually a nice way to look at it. In fact, the token-based model is something I'm going to reflect on. I never thought of it that way. It's interesting. But yes, this was extremely fun to do. Thanks for actually making this happen. And apart from a lot of philosophy, our listeners probably got a bit of knowledge on whether they should invest in crypto or not. So
I would not take investment advice from myself, just so you know. I did not do a good job with this. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, as in the sense that there were multiple opportunities and multiple times I didn't take them. And I feel like my wife and I sit and look at each other and say, we've just been idiots.
Yeah.
But at least we've learned a lesson for, I don't know, 30 years from now when the next information innovation comes in. We will put money in.
Yeah, I don't know if I read it on your LinkedIn or someone else's, but Aaron Levy tweeted saying, what did he say?
He says, that feeling when you see the Bitcoin price and think this is it, and then you see it go up, and you just say you think this is it, and you don't put money in, and you see it go up every day for the past 4 years.
Oh yeah,
and I think,
4 years.
And I think that's actually so.
That's
true.
More than a bubble.
So true.
Thanks so much, Rohan. Thanks for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.